find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at KaleidoScience, Conversations on Cognitive Science. The first time I heard about deep brain stimulation, so getting an electrode into your brain that sends or stimulates or inhibits certain brain areas, was really striking to me. So like, I couldn't imagine how, well, I could imagine, but it was just scary, creepy for me to imagine having a wire in my brain that can change how I perceive, feel, and see the world, at least at a small level. It doesn't manipulate my thoughts, or wouldn't, but it's still impacting people's lives. And I really wanted to have that topic on the podcast as well, which is why we invited today's guest, who's Dora Meyer-Doll, who's a PhD at the University Clinic in Freiburg in the Department for Interventional Biological Psychiatry, and is currently doing her PhD there. And I'm really looking forward to today's interview.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And to start off, we're going to play a little get-to-know game with you. This is just short sentence beginnings, and you should just complete them. Don't overthink it too much. As a kid, I always wanted to be.
I do not remember having a specific dream job, but I do remember that in elementary school I wrote dentist or marine biologist in these friendship books.
That are two quite different professions.
Yeah, I think so too.
For me, it was also marine biologist.
I think that one is quite common. I still think it's fascinating, but to be honest, I would be far too scared to practice it.
Totally fair, yeah.
Makes sense. If I was an emoji, I would be.
I think a sunflower.
Why sunflower? Cute. Nobody has said this before, I think.
No.
I really like putting it in messages, and I think it's just a friendly one.
And my favorite thing to do on a day off is?
I like to go out. I like to go out for a walk with my family. I like to meet friends, read a nice book, something like that.
That sounds very nice. Right now, I'm most fascinated by...
Well, I've been following up the election process in the US for quite a bit. I don't know if fascinating is the right, or if it has a positive association in this case, but yeah, it's been something I've been reading a lot of in the newspaper.
Yeah, I feel similarly about it.
I have to admit, I just ignore the whole topic at the moment.
Also fair. I know it's time to call it a day when.
When I start making errors in my typing, if I forget, did I already press save or not? And where did I save this specific document?
Okay, I want to introduce you a little more as a person. So you're a PhD student now in Freiburg. Could you tell us a little more of your journey there? What you did before, what you studied, and how you got there?
When I started my bachelor's in psychology at the University of Regensburg, I had the idea to become a psychotherapist. And then I realized very quickly that I find biological psychology and neuropsychology really interesting. And that was something I would not have expected necessarily. But for that reason, I decided on a master's program that, besides clinical psychology, also focused on neuropsychology, and I moved to Freiburg. And when I was about to finish my master's, I realized that I didn't feel ready to become a psychotherapist yet. And I would have liked to study some more, but I also wanted to earn a bit of money. And that is why I turned to research. And I actually found a job advertisement of the Department of Interventional and Biological Psychiatry, and I was really intrigued because to me this sounded like the perfect match for my interests, working with patients, but having this biological approach and doing research. So I got the job, and I think it's held its promises. And at the beginning I worked mainly in a study investigating the efficacy of SLMFB-DBS in treatment-resistant depression, and that study is still ongoing. But after some time I decided to do a PhD, and I developed a research question and design together with Professor Schlepfer, who is also head of the department, and with Professor Heinrichs, who is my supervisor from the university. And yeah, right now I'm mainly doing this, but I'm still involved in everyday processes of the department, but now to a much smaller extent than before.
You mentioned one abbreviation where you totally lost me.
Oh.
Could you maybe just say what it is? Because like, I'm also really bad with the order of letters, and I always mix that up myself. And so I'm not trying to repeat what you've said, but could you just maybe explain shortly what
was that means? Was it SLMFB-DBS?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, so DBS is short for deep brain stimulation, and SLMFB is short for superolateral medial forebrain bundle, and that is the stimulation target.
Could you, for people who don't know that well, like where brain areas are, give like a rough explanation using like ears or eyes as landmarks?
It's in the midbrain, so really some deep in the brain. I think deep in the brain is enough.
So is it, does deep in the brain kind of mean that it's in the center and all the other layers are around it, or is...
Yeah. So it's not in the cortex area, but it's deeper down.
Okay. And we've already heard that already had something to do with deep brain stimulation, or DBS, which you're also doing a PhD on now. Could you maybe really shortly explain what deep brain stimulation is? And, well, I tried to introduce it, but I quite likely also didn't do a really great job at that.
Deep brain stimulation, or DBS, is an invasive medical intervention or treatment. It means that a patient undergoes a neurosurgical procedure and receives a stimulation system that is permanently implanted. And this device applies chronic electrical stimulation to a predefined target in the brain. In general, so the SLMFB is a specific target. And I said it before, I think, but the stimulation system consists of a pulse generator that is similar to a cardiac pacemaker. And that is in most cases implanted right below your collarbone. And then there are two electrodes, one for each hemisphere of the brain, that are implanted at the brain target that has been chosen. And the electrodes and the pacemaker are connected by a lead or lead extension that runs beneath the skin. So normally you do not see this system from the outside. If people do not have any hair, sometimes you can see it a bit And if people are very skinny, you may also see the pulse generator.
And then the pacemaker kind of stimulates brain areas and activates or deactivates them, or is it more like just sending an impulse?
Yeah, it's more sending an impulse. And I think we are on the safe side if we say it modulates the activity of the brain tissue.
And it's like, do people or patients feel that there's kind of electric currency going into their brain? Because the brain doesn't have any pain receptors. So I would assume they don't feel pain for being or having a brain area stimulated. But do they feel a tickling or something in their brain?
So normally not. So once the system is implanted and all wounds have healed, patients normally do not feel the stimulation. But they do feel if the stimulation parameters are adjusted. So there's are different ways to program this device. And these adjustments can make the patients feel a bit dizzy. They can get sweaty, and but that is specific for our target. They can experience double pictures because the supralateral medial forebrain bundle runs very close to the oculomotor nerve. That and this nerve could be co-stimulated, and then this produces these kind of double pictures, and that always means you have to reduce the voltage, and then the double pictures disappear. And also, if the stimulation is running chronically, so there's always some kind of stimulation, and then it is turned off, some patients, but not all patients, experience that their symptoms come back immediately. And that, of course, is something that is not very pleasant. And deep brain stimulation is also applied for, or mainly applied for, neurologic disorders, especially Parkinson's disease, for this tremor you might know from Parkinson's disease. And in those patients, that is really visible. So if you turn off the stimulation, the tremor comes back immediately.
So you talked about adjustment. So if I imagine this pacemaker, so it's constantly running, and with adjustments, it's usually voltage. It's not current, right?
Okay, so I'm not the right person to tell you about that in detail, but in general, depending on the model of electrodes and also the model of pacemakers, you have different possibilities to adjust the stimulation. And the electrodes we use, for example, in the ongoing study, have, I think, 8 contacts. And then you can always combine those differently, how much current goes to which contact, and is it polled negatively or positively, and the amount of current that goes in total. So there's really a lot of combinations that you could program.
That's really cool.
You mentioned that in, I think also in your PhD, you're mainly looking at the medial forebrain bundle, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why is the deep brain stimulation applied in the medial forebrain bundle? Why did you choose, or why was that brain area chosen, and how was it connected, especially to OCD and depression?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the medial forebrain bundle is a white matter fiber tract, and it has been known in vertebrates for a long time. So it I looked it up, and it has been described for the first time in 1882 in a mole. And by the beginning of the 21st century, it has been well known that the medial forebrain bundle plays a crucial role in the brain reward system in especially mice and rats. And at the same time, knowledge about the medial forebrain bundle in humans has been quite fragmented. So the first attempt to characterize the human medial forebrain bundle anatomically has been described in 2012, I think, by Volker Koenen, and that is also the neurosurgeon who performs all the surgeries in the patients we treat at our department. And you may have noticed the difference between supralateral medial forebrain bundle and medial forebrain bundle, and that is because it turned out that the human medial forebrain bundle has a second branch, and that is different from rats and mice. And this supralateral branch is connected to other brain structures that are highly important for emotion processing. So, in total, the medial forebrain bundle is quite a large structure, and now the target point for the SLMFB stimulation lies where the supralateral branch is very dense, and this is in the midbrain. And why has it been selected? In short, we think that the medial forebrain bundle is very important for various aspects of reward processing, from very basic to very complex aspects. Basic aspect of emotion or reward processing would be to add an affective tone to a certain stimulus. I like it or I dislike it. And a complex one would be to act upon the stimulus in a flexible manner, depending on the social context, for example. And it has been shown that the neural reward network is somehow impaired in treatment-resistant depression, as well as in obsessive-compulsive disorder. And now the idea is that by stimulating the SLMFB, we aim at normalizing the activity in this network. So, yeah, this is the idea of the SLMFB in very, very short. And there are other targets as well. So other research groups target other brain areas.
For the reward system or for a different purpose?
Actually, this is an ongoing debate. Do, especially in OCD, do all research groups in the end activate or modulate the same network, or is there a substantial overlap, but every target has its own specific effects as well? Yeah. Some of them are really close together, or in some cases, because of the several contacts of the electrode, you can, in fact, switch between targets. But yeah, I'm not a neurobiologist and no neurosurgeon. But of course, everyone has a rationale behind their favorite target. So if you would like to know in more depth why the SLMFB has been chosen as a target, I would recommend the two rationale papers that have been published. The first one was from Schlepfer and colleagues in 2014, and then an updated rationale for SLMFB-DBS in treatment-resistant depression and in OCD has been published in 2022. So that is quite new.
And when you say reward system, could you explain a little bit what the reward system is?
I think I would like to answer this on a cognitive level and not so much on a biological level. And the way I think about it, and to simplify it for myself, is I don't know if you remember the song by Ariana Grande, Seven Rings. The chorus of this song is, I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it. And for me, this perfectly narrows down reward processing. Because at first, you have to see it, you have to detect a potentially rewarding stimuli. You then have to decide if you like it or not. You add a a affective component to it. You evaluate it somehow. And this is the basic part. Then it gets more complicated. I want it. This means there's kind of a discrepancy between the current status and the status you want to reach. And in order to get there, you must engage in some form of behavior. So depending on what the stimulus is, you just take it, you buy it, you ask for it, you decide the price is too high and you do not want it that much. So this is the complex part and also the flexible behavior part. And all of these steps are interconnected, and there are certain brain structures that are more relevant for different aspects of it, and they are interconnected, and the idea is that the SLMFB also links areas that are relevant for different aspects of this, of this process. And of course, there are more subcategories of reward processing than this Ariana Grande song, but I think it gives you an idea.
And what has reward to do with depression and OCD?
For depression, this is quite intuitive, actually, because the main symptoms of depression are depressed mood and also loss of interest and pleasure. And especially that loss of interest and pleasure part is also referred as anhedonia. And if you think back of this reward thing I just told you, losing interest and pleasure is similar to not being able to add an effective quality to the experiences or the things around you, the people around you. They lose the ability to, or not always lose in total, but there's a reduced ability to experience joy or pleasure. And we think that this has to do with a deficiency in the reward processing.
So in depression, like, it's not a specific part of the reward system, if I understand correctly, but you don't even have the I like it, I want it anymore, right?
Exactly. And if you decide to do it anyway, to keep up a hobby, although you do not feel the drive and the joy anymore, this is extremely exhausting. I think everybody has done things they don't want to do at the moment, but if most things you do during your day, you have to decide to do it anyway, this is extremely challenging and exhausting. And so this means that these top-down processes, these cognitive processes, I'll do it anyway, have to jump in for those more bottom-up processes, these more automatic processes that are extremely reduced. And by stimulating the system, we hope to find a or create a homeostasis again between these processes.
And where does it apply in OCD?
Yeah, okay. In OCD, this is a bit different. Should I maybe tell you a bit what OCD is?
Yes, because please. I think it's also depending, like, yeah, just, yeah.
So, obsessive compulsive disorder is just like depression, a psychiatric disorder, and it's characterized by intruding unpleasant thoughts. We call that obsessions, and or repetitive rigid behaviors. We call that compulsions. And these obsessions and compulsions can be of very different content or can have very different content. For example, some people with OCD are overly afraid of contamination and therefore clean themselves or their homes excessively. And it is important to note that these thoughts and behaviors may seem bizarre to outsiders. And the patients know that themselves. They know that, but they cannot prevent themselves from thinking these thoughts or from engaging into these behaviors, or only with great effort. And for that reason, OCD is often associated with difficulties in social interaction, and it often goes along with other psychiatric disorders, especially depression. So now to come back to your question, I have made some notes on that. So in OCD, these affective aspects of reward processing that I just told you, they are seem tuned down in depression. Those seem overly active in OCD. So especially if you think about these compulsions, patients feel driven or they feel the need to perform certain behaviors. For example, someone might feel they have to count the steps between two streetlights, and the number of steps needs to be even. And if it is not, this will just feel wrong, and they will find a walking pattern to make the number even. And yeah, as I said, they know that there's no rational reason for this. Still, to resist this compulsion, they need a lot of willpower, and it makes them feel extremely uncomfortable. So again, these cognitive top-down processes need to jump in, because the affective aspects of reward processing are so intense. So we would like to reduce these overly affective, active part to ease the burden. So in those disorders, the intervention or the idea of the intervention is a bit opposite, but the aim is still the same, to create a homeostasis between these bottom-up and top-down processes.
So in depression, this top-down was kind of more effortful for patients, mm-hmm. and is it in OCD, is it the bottom-up that is more demanding, or the top down as well?
I would say normally top down is always the more effortful.
Mm-hmm.
Although, of course, follow along with those compulsions and cleaning all day long or counting all day long is also exhausting. But in both cases, these top-down processes mean to act differently from what you would feel like to do.
Mm-hmm. Is it just for me, myself, is it an OCD that kind of you want to train or allow the reward system to learn different? Because I would assume that following your obsessive thoughts or your compulsions gives a rewarding feeling to the patients. So how far does that follow a similar pattern or similar approach as when people don't have any reward motivation feeling at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is not totally clear. There's literature that says OCD is similar to addiction. The behavior is so rewarding that you do it over and over again. And there's also literature that says people chase this reward feeling, but it doesn't come. So they repeat it and repeat it and hope for it to come, to get this. I can make a check behind it. So I finished this task. So I cannot say for sure which one is right or if it depends on the patient. But yeah.
I think it's a very interesting that in OCD, despite your behavior being irrational and also like stressful for yourself, I assume. Like I can mm-hmm. imagine if you're in a social situation and you know that you're behaving not normal to the social standard consistently, that it still apparently gives you so much reward, or like that it's so difficult to suppress it that you still have to do it.
Yeah, actually, a lot of patients reduce their social interactions, and my impression is that it's not so much about the rewarding aspect of doing these compulsions, for example, but if you ask patients how would it make you feel if someone prevented you from doing this, they say the idea of not being able to do this makes them so anxious and panicky. So it's more driven by fear than by reward. At least that is my impression.
Okay. And just to clarify one more time for me, so the difference between, like, for example, somebody who has OCD related to cleanliness and somebody who just likes their home clean is that the person who likes their home clean cleans it, but because they want to, and if they don't make it, they still feel okay about themselves, while somebody with OCD, if they don't clean up to their standard, they would feel stressed and panicky.
Yeah, and very often in OCD this escalates, so you start, I don't know, cleaning for an hour a day, and then you think, oh, maybe there's still something, I should add another hour. And patients may spend their whole day cleaning, and this does not feel good in the end. And still, after a whole day of cleaning, there may be a thought like, is it clean enough? Did I actually do it? Did I do it right? Maybe I should repeat it. I think this burdening, the experience of this behavior being burdening for them is an important aspect of the diagnosis. So if someone acts strange and says, so I'm totally fine with that, and I like it clean, although you might say that's a bit much, why should you diagnose them with OCD, him or her.
Having a deep brain stimulation implanted is quite invasive. So how is decided who gets or who is treated by deep brain stimulation? When is a depression or OCD in specifically your cases serve enough to be treated by that? Or how would, like, I think you mentioned that they have to be treatment resistant, but what does that even mean?
Okay. So in general, we have treatment options for depression and for OCD as well. In depression, that is different kinds of medication, psychotherapy, some kind of stimulation treatments. And they work for most of the patients. But there is a substantial part of patients who do not benefit from this standard evidence-based treatments. And there is no definite definition of treatment resistancy, but it always refers to the guidelines in Germany, that is the S3 Leitlinie, and it may vary from country to country in the details, but if someone has used all standard treatments and it doesn't work or it doesn't work sufficiently, then they can be described as treatment resistant. And for depression, or for our study, for our ongoing study on depression, I can tell you what we need, or what we ask the patients to have tried out. For our current study, patients must have received antidepressants from at least 3 different classes, at least 2 different augmentation or combination strategies that must have failed, electroconvulsive therapy must have failed, and psychotherapy as well. And also, depressive symptoms must be present for at least 2 years, or at least 5 depressive episodes must be documented. Even if they fulfill all of these criterions, the decision is still kind of difficult. We screen the documentation from other hospitals, from psychiatrists, psychotherapists. We meet the patients at least twice to hear their story, to get an idea of their everyday life. We discuss the potential risks and benefits of the treatment with the patients, but also in our team. And then we come to a decision. And I think this risk part is important as well. I have not talked about that yet, but as any surgery, DBS comes with risks, and patients as well as clinicians should be aware of that. And at the same time, I think you can imagine if someone is thinking about going under neurosurgery, there must be, some suffering. You do not do this just for fun. And for OCD, the criterions are a bit different because there's more evidence on DBS and OCD already. So patients can receive the treatment in or under compassionate use, I think it's called in English. And then it's you still look into the treatments they've had, and in many cases we recommend going back to a certain kind of psychotherapy. So the most effective treatment for OCD so far is psychotherapy with exposure and response prevention, which means that they go into the situations they are most afraid of and stay there and do not engage into their compulsions. So this, of course, is very unpleasant, but also helpful in many cases. And there's also medication that can be helpful. But as we are also currently not doing a study on OCD, those criterions are a bit less defined. Regarding the severity of the disorders, of course, patients tell you how they feel and that they are suffering a lot. We still try to pin a number to the severity of symptoms using different kinds of clinician interviews and questionnaires. And especially if you do a study, there's normally a cutoff score that patients have to fulfill. And even though we do not do a study right now in OCD, we still do a standardized interview and we look into, we still use a cutoff score because it somehow quantifies symptom severity, although I know that it never captures the complexity of the disorder as a whole.
Yeah. And is there general evidence for how good or how well deep brain stimulation works in really serve cases of depression or OCD? It's like you mentioned that in OCD it's better research, but...
There are, in both cases, there are some meta-analyses. And I mentioned before that there are different brain targets. So the meta-analysis combine all targets and all cases. So it is a very general answer. But the most recent meta-analysis on treatment-resistant depression is from this year. It's from Reddy and colleagues from a research group in Houston, and they found that in the long run, 48% of the patients responded to the treatment, which means that they had a substantial benefit, and that 35% of the patients reached remission. Remission means that they do not longer fulfill the diagnostic criteria of a current depressive episode. However, and I think that is important, this effect is not necessarily immediate, but the estimated time to reach the response criterion is about 2 years. And the latest meta-analysis on DBS and OCD is also from the Houston Research Group. It's published by Godot and colleagues in 2022, and they found that 66% of patients responded to the treatment in the long term. And remembering the treatment resistancy I talked about before, this is really a great outcome. At the same time, unfortunately, this means that there are also patients who do not respond at all or only a little bit. And for our very own research, I can say that the research group has so far completed 2 trials on SLMFB-DBS in treatment-resistant depression. The first one was an open-label pilot study. The second one was an RCT with 16 patients. And the very most part of these patients really responded quite quickly. In the second study, half of the patients were classified as remitters after 1 year. And so this is very promising. And as I said, the third study is still ongoing. We will include about 50 patients in total. So it's a larger study. And I think right now all patients have been included, but not all of them have completed the trial. So I cannot. Or we are still waiting for the results. Yeah. And for OCD, as I said, we are not doing a study right now, but we treat some patients under compassionate use, and I think we have so far treated 14 patients. As we do not do a study, it's a bit more difficult to say something about the efficacy, but we still try to analyze the data from our clinical routine. And when we did that for the first 9 of our patients, 7 of them had reached the response criterion after 1 year of treatment. So this is also looking good, I think.
It's just like my first thought was about half doesn't sound too good. But when you think about that, you have patients who have really served cases who were before labeled as treatment resistant, then 50% is really good.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
And when you say it's a gradual process, it's a little bit hard for me to imagine because you implant this machine and you kind of start it. Is it gradual because you need some time to find the right settings for it, basically? And do they feel like, so over these 2 years, do they get better a little bit until after 2 years they hopefully feel better if it works on them? Or are there like jumps in there? Mm-hmm.
So I think there are multiple components. You have to find the right settings. The brain has to adjust to there suddenly being an electrode inside of it, and it applies current. And the course of improvement is not linear in most cases, and it might go up and down. There might be setbacks, there might be even relapses. But in general, if it works, it's a gradual process. And also, how should I put this? A patient once said to me that they feel like DBS does not take away the symptoms. They do not vanish, but DBS provides a solid basis to work on. But this still means you have to work on it. And we always recommend psychotherapy along DBS. Some patients say, I could never really engage in psychotherapy. It didn't help me at all. But now I get it. And especially the patients with OCD, if you have engaged in this kind of compulsions for a very long time, they might also become habits. So even if the pressure, let's say pressure is lower because of deep brain stimulation, there might still be the habit to do it. Or you might need to find something else to do. Because if all your day has been dominated by this obsessions and compulsions, you need to fill it differently. So this might sound a bit strange, but you need to rearrange with your situation.
Yeah, I think it makes total sense, though. If you spend like 5 hours a day cleaning or sorting things, or whatever your compulsion might be, you have 5 hours where you don't do that anymore. So I think it makes total sense. And you said in the beginning that once you stop the deep brain stimulation, the symptoms come back immediately. So
this is not the case for all patients, but for some.
Is there like any evidence on, because I would imagine that when they still have to do the relearning, so like when, for example, for depression, they find it easier to make changes but they still have to make them themselves. Or for OCD, they might lose the pressure for following a certain behavior, but they kind of still have the habit. So, like, is there any evidence or any pattern behind if kind of having changed behaviors or habits or routines impacts, and how far the impact of turning off the deep brain stimulation is?
I don't know that.
Okay.
It's an interesting question, but I would not know of any studies so far or any evidence so far. In my PhD project, I ask patients to turn off the stimulation for about an hour. And some say it's really, they feel less concentrated, or depressive thoughts come back, or obsessive thoughts come back. And some say they do not realize anything being different. So I take notes of that, and I can imagine that those who profit the most from DBS might also feel the strongest difference between on and off, but I can't tell for sure.
And is there anything known about a possible placebo effect or nocebo in that case? Because could be placebo, but is there anything known about that?
That's a totally valid question. Also, regarding my PhD project, because patients turn off the stimulation themselves, so this is unblinded. And especially in the efficacy studies, if they are RCTs, there is normally sham stimulation versus actual stimulation. And what you see mostly in the efficacy studies is a substantial effect compared to baseline, but also in this meta-analysis, for depression at least, they did not find a statistically significant difference between sham and active stimulation, a trend but not an actual effect. And there might be different reasons for that, especially there can be a placebo effect. Imagine you receive a experimental treatment that not a lot of patients in the world have received yet, so you would expect it to work. And if the sham phase is too short, the placebo effect might might just still be ongoing when the actual stimulation comes in. And additionally, it's been observed that there is a effect of the surgery itself. So many patients experience improvement right after surgery, even before the device has been turned on. There's a test stimulation during surgery, but it's also the manipulation of the brain during surgery, along with anesthesia, that might have an influence. And for that reason, it's quite difficult to differentiate between placebo effect and any other kind of effect. And then if you do crossover studies, that means in the run of the study, the study arms may switch. So those who had active stimulation before now receive sham stimulation. And if you had sham stimulation, you cross over to active stimulation. In a lot of cases, if patients have received stimulation before, they will realize when it's turned off. So there might be a nocebo effect at this point. And I think study design is really not easy. And if you think about the result that this course of improvement often takes 2 years, a really good study design would mean you have a sham phase for 2 years. And this is just not ethically possible. We now have in our study, or in the last study, the sham phase was 2 months, I think. And this is already hard for patients. They've been waiting for such a long time, and now they might wait even longer for the treatment. So I don't think you could say, okay, let's do a sham phase for 1 year or 2 years.
Yeah.
I have one more question, which kind of ties into the stimulation working continuously. What kind of maintenance is there to keep the stimulation working? Like, do they have to get checked regularly, or does mm-hmm. the machine have to do something regularly?
Mm-hmm. Great question. It depends on the device that has been, or on the, especially on the pulse generator that has been implanted. Most of the patients that we treat right now have a rechargeable stimulator, and that means they have a charging device that they have to put above the stimulator, and depending on the program setting, every once a week to every 3 to 4 weeks, they have to recharge the device. There are also devices with a battery that can't be recharged, and then the device has to be exchanged after a certain amount of time, like 5 years or something. And this might, of course, also be a risk that the stimulator just turns off because it needs charging, or the battery is empty. And if patients do not realize that this is the case, and their symptoms get worse, this might be even dramatic. You know, depression goes along in some cases with suicidal ideation. So this is something patients always need to keep in mind. If symptoms get worse and they have no idea why, they should always check their stimulator. Is it still on, and is it charged properly? And we also encourage them to come in regularly, every 3 to 6 months, just to see if everything still works the way it should, and if the settings should be adjusted.
Okay, so what do you think are, like, in one or two sentences, the most important takeaways from this episode for people who are interested in deep brain stimulation and to treat OCD and depression?
I think, Elisa, you said at the beginning that when you heard about this for the first time, it mostly scared you. And I would like to say that it is not necessary to be scared of this. It can be a great treatment for a lot of patients, but we should be so honest as to say it will not be a great treatment for everyone, and it is still experimental and under investigation. And I think it's really important to do the anamnestic part very carefully, and also keep an open mind about other less invasive treatment options before you recommend DBS? Maybe this is it. Be open-minded about this, about the application, but also about not applying it.
I think that's a good closing. Then I have one last question for you, though. What would you say, what role does cognition play in your research?
Well, I think it has become clear that cognition is a great part of depression and of OCD. So, yeah, these psychiatric disorders themselves are the link to cognition, I would say.
Okay. So thank you, Dora, for joining our podcast.
Thank you so much for your interest and for inviting me again.
It was very interesting talking to you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You've listened to Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Clara Kühne, Imogen Hüsing, Elisa Palmer, Leslie Volk, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Luka Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through Conversations on Cognitive Science. This podcast is not sponsored and does not give us any financial profit. If you wish to support us, the most effective way is to do so by leaving us an up to 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and following us on Instagram. You can reach out to us via mail, comment on YouTube, or message us on Instagram. We are always happy to hear your feedback. Thank you again for listening to us and for your interest in science. If you have any questions regarding this episode or any of our other episodes, feel free to reach out. You can reach out to us via Instagram by sending us a direct message at kaleidoscience_pod or write us an email at kaleidopod@us.de. You can find both links to our Instagram and also the email address in our show notes. We do read all your comments and will also reply to you as soon as we can.